CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Journalism is printing what somebody else does not want printed. Everything else is just public relations. And increasingly, everything is just public relations. Look, we're down below 12,000 journalists left in Canada. Meanwhile, the PR, communications, and advertising industries now employ over 160,000 people in this country. So yeah, we are outnumbered, like 13 to 1. Doesn't always have to be a fight. I mean, like, the day-to-day interactions between us and them, it's usually pretty banal, even friendly, you know? We routinely will ask a person or organization for comment, and their PR flack is the person who gets back to us. And then, you know, we take that comment to the other subject in the story. Their flack responds. We can tell them what time our deadline is. They usually try to accommodate us. Everybody tries to get home in time for dinner. Just another day at the office. If you're lucky enough to have a story that somebody really, really does not want to see published, and when that somebody has deep pockets and everything to lose, things can get intense. I don't know if you're familiar with the term war room, but a war room is when you and a couple of colleagues in the newsroom are up against an ad hoc team of high-priced lawyers, crisis communications experts, investigators, researchers, an entire team often working around the clock on behalf of somebody who wants to stop your journalism. That's when the 13 to 1 ratio feels very, very real. Your job is to get the truth out, and their job, all of them, is to hide the truth, warp it, overwhelm it, distract from it, whatever it takes, often by making you a target. Newsrooms keep getting smaller, but nothing else is changing. Governments still routinely lie, and companies are still making false claims, and police departments still routinely mislead the public. The only thing standing between the way they want you to see everything and the way things actually are is us, and we're hardly even here anymore. Cecil Rosner is an award-winning journalist who worked for the CBC for 31 years. He was the executive producer of The Fifth Estate, and he was the managing editor of CBC Manitoba. He's written a book called Manipulating the Message, How Powerful Forces Shape the News. And he's got some ideas about how we can push back. Cecil Rosner joins me and our editor-in-chief, Karen Pugliese, in a moment. Wait for it.
Let's talk a little bit about public relations. You've been doing it for 70 years. Who were some of your early accounts?
In the very beginning, Procter & Gamble. They had a white floating soap called the Ivory Soap.
Right. That was the selling point. It would actually float in the bathtub.
And they came to me one day and said that mothers washed the faces of the children and they hated soap because their eyes were stinging from the soap. And that when people grew up, they wouldn't use any soap
right.
Because they get conditioned in childhood, according to Freud, my uncle.
So you get ahead of yourself, but it's true, your uncle was Sigmund Freud.
And so we made a research, made a study, and we found a sculptor who used soap instead of wax. And it then occurred to me that if we could develop soap sculpture competitions, I went to a psychologist and he said every child has a creative instinct.
That would get them accustomed to using the soap.
That would get them to love soap.
Did it work?
Only accustomed to it. The fascinating thing to me was that after the first year, 22 million children were loving soap, and the sale of soap just went up.
Well, if you say so.
Who is it that Letterman is speaking to in this clip in question?
He's talking to Edward Bernays, who is widely recognized as one of the founders of the discipline of public relations.
I'm here with our editor-in-chief, Karen Puglisi, as well. Karen, have you heard of this guy before?
You know what? I didn't know the name until I actually read Cecil's book.
I don't know that I've ever seen Letterman interview a man this old. I think he's in his 90s, he says at one point.
Thank you very much for being here. I mentioned to the people how old you were. I hope you don't mind me telling them that.
Everybody has five ages, and they don't match. I happen to be 93 chronologically.
Right.
But I'm 61 physiologically. Mentally, I don't know, I suppose I'm 45. Mm-hmm. And societally, how I adjust to other people, uh-huh. I wouldn't quiver. If I saw poor Mr. Reagan, I'd say, hi, Reagan. And emotionally, I won't tell that to anybody.
So now you won't tell your emotional age to anybody?
No. Will you tell yours?
Well, based on your statistics, I've passed on weeks ago.
That's right. 93 years old. He's a very charming person. By the time of that interview, he had an incredibly long career that encompassed being a counsel to various presidents of the United States, all kinds of major corporations in the U.S. And if you study public relations today, if you take it in a university or community college, he's held out to be one of the foremost theoreticians of public relations.
It's a pretty friendly interview, and Letterman is asking him these genial questions about the original marketing of Ivory soap. Like, it's literally about a product that's so pure it floats. So he seems like a really nice old guy. What would you ask this guy if you were in Letterman's seat?
Bernays was not shy about using the word propaganda. In fact, one of his main textbooks on public relations is called Propaganda. It was published in 1928. Bernays was really introduced to the whole idea of propaganda in a big way during World War I, where the American government tried to sell the war and its participation in the war to its population, and he took part in that. And then he realized after the war was over that, hey, we can use some of these techniques in peacetime to the benefit of companies and presidents and clients. And from that, he developed his whole thesis of how to manipulate public opinion. And so I would have asked him about that. I would have asked him about just the whole very cynical idea that, you know, the hidden persuaders, the people that are really in charge, that are really in control, are the people who can manipulate people's ideas.
That's fascinating. So the birth of PR came from selling people war. Like, if we could sell them on a war, then maybe we could sell them on soap or on the health benefits of cigarettes.
That's exactly what Bernays says.
We're talking about the United States, but here for journalists in Canada, to what extent are we actually reporting news, or to what extent are we actually stenographers for, you know, governments and think tanks?
Over the years, the number of journalists has been shrinking. And at the same time, the number of publicists and communications people has been vastly increasing. Like, in 1991, there were about 13,000 reporters in Canada, in this big country of ours. That's it. And at the time, there were a little over 20,000 people who checked off the box, I work in public relations and communications. That was in 1991. And 30 years later, in 2021, the number of reporters had declined to about 11,000. But the number of PR and communications people had increased to 160,000. If you follow the news, you know that journalism schools are pausing and shutting down. The enrollment is declining. It's kind of scary. There's a bit of an existential threat to journalism, I think. And at the same time, more and more and more communication publicist jobs are being created. So when you talk about stenography, we have fewer and fewer people trying to interpret more and more messages from companies and governments and police departments and military and think tanks and all of these organizations that are seeking to push their message out via the media. So yes, I totally agree. We're in danger of having a lot of stenography and not enough investigation, analysis, fact-checking, verification. I was in charge of a big newsroom for the CBC for many years, CBC Manitoba. Our people had to feed multiple platforms every day, TV, radio, online. Every time you're reversioning your story for another platform, it's that many fewer minutes you have to actually verify the facts that you have. And to me, that's a major problem facing journalism today.
Cecil, you say it's scary. The story that you tell is actually terrifying. You know, and this very compelling image that we're outnumbered, you know, what is it, 10 to 1, 14 to 1, that the truth tellers are just overpowered. You know, this isn't just you. Like, journalists always talk about it as the dark side. We're up against the forces of evil. Is it really that scary? Because I wake up every morning to like a dozen press releases. Here, these are from today. Hi, Jesse. Here's a story of Ontario winters, of our remembered past. Potentially coming back with a vengeance, I'd be happy to arrange an interview with a first on-site specialist to provide tips for businesses and homeowners to protect their property during winter. Kyle Troscott, Account Coordinator, Maverick Public Relations. Hi there. This one, they don't know my name. Hello Safe releases today a new report on the Canadian home insurance market. The Hello Safe team is at your disposal. Last one. For immediate release, what a year it has been. The rec laws are closing out 2023 at the top of the charts, scoring their fourth number one Canadian country radio hit today, Honky Tonkin' About. The majority of press releases that I get every day, I immediately throw out. They are almost always boring, obvious, and amateurish. They are almost always stories that anybody who's done any research, why would we send this to Jesse at Canada Land? If you knew what we are, you'd know that we would never cover this story. And I just get the sense with each of these that just some PR company took some sucker's check and blasted this press release out to like 1,000 people in the media without any kind of discrimination. You know, it's spammy. It's a blunt force strategy. Is the PR industry really this all-powerful dark force?
There are people who do it very well, and there are people who do it poorly. I give many examples. Here's one. Alan Thompson, he was a former Toronto Star reporter. He's now head of the journalism department at Carleton University. He ran for parliament in Southern Ontario. He told me that sometimes no journalists came to some of his meetings that he organized. When that happened, he himself, as a former reporter, wrote a press release and sent it to various news outlets in his riding. And he said he was amazed to discover that often they would write a news story based solely on the news story he had supplied them. He, the candidate. In some cases, they reprinted his press release verbatim. I have talked to a number of people in the public relations business. This story comes up repeatedly. They say, Cecil, the stuff we put out is often printed verbatim, including the headlines that we suggest and the quotes that we supply. And I have seen this time and time again. So yes, there are bad examples of the ones you cited, but there are also very good examples. And here's the insidious part. Anytime there's a major announcement, a fiscal update, a budget, there's always a leak. A news organization will always say the day before, we have learned what's going to be in the budget. Here's a little tidbit for you. This is the government playing the media, giving little bits of information to the Globe and Mail and another little bit to CTV and another little bit to CBC, who then revel in the fact that they have some kind of exclusive scoop. And it's not the clumsy press release you talked about. It's the more sophisticated, I will whisper something in your ear. You will attribute it to a source who is not authorized to speak publicly, and you will have a pseudo scoop. Meanwhile, we will have delivered our message out to the public with maximum effect. So this goes on a daily basis.
Not only is Cecil right that happens, but I've done it. I was on the dark side.
I was going to say, I know that not all PR flacks are like amateurish because you used to be one.
Well, okay. Now, I'm going to say I never did anything that I thought was wrong.
Sure, sure.
But was I successful at manipulating media? You bet I was. I knew reporters because I'd been a reporter, and I knew which reporters to leak.
Who did you work for?
Oh, I worked for Assembly of First Nations.
So this is like political messaging.
Assembly of First Nations is a lobby group that represents chiefs across Canada, and it is one of the most successful, arguably successful lobby groups. It has created like a third power in between, you know, English and French Canada. The rise of the Assembly of First Nations really was an intervention into the Canadian political system.
So what was your greatest hits when it comes to manipulating media?
Okay, so I do have a story. I did the things that C said. I knew the more that I wrote a press release to sound like a news story instead of a press release, the more likely it was to get picked up. I would give reporters that I thought would do a good job on the story and, to me, understand the story and get the message that we wanted out, the story. This didn't mean that the story was wrong or that it was necessarily a lie, but I was definitely hedging my bets on getting stories out. So there was one where we're trying to attract attention to tuberculosis. And I don't want to say the reporter because it's a good reporter, but I knew if I gave that reporter the story, it was going to get national attention. And that story blew up the minute that reporter filed that story.
So you manipulated the media for the force of good.
I think so.
Cecil, you kind of cover all of the different dark arts and the different methodologies that the press falls for kind of reliably every time. And you have a chapter dedicated to think tanks, the widespread understanding of think tanks as just like places where really smart people go to think. What a great job for these brainiacs to do their research. They exist, many of them, to put forth a bias, an agenda. And, you know, you do a great job of documenting how it's not unlike Hallmark inventing Mother's Day or Valentine's Day, but like, you know, there's a conservative taxpayers group that has created this annual event that the media falls for reliably every year. Oh, this is the day of whatever it's called, taxpayer independence. Up till this day, every dollar you made has gone to the government.
Tax Freedom Day.
Tax Freedom Day. And every year, it's a stroke of genius. It inspires stories every year. And we even know that where it's coming from, but we do it. It's just one trick of many. Very sophisticated ways that they are able to launder their message through news journalists. But I think the puck has moved. PR is not press relations. PR is public relations. And they're only interested in us to the extent that we are the ones who people get their information from. If people are getting their information elsewhere, then that's where PR is going. And the big win of manipulating a journalist or getting them to do stenography, press release journalism, well, it doesn't really get you much. I mean, I guess you could show your client, here's all the earned media that your money bought. So it can make it look like you did your job. But if you really are trying to move the needle on what people think, I wonder if you don't even care about what's in the newspaper anymore. How many people are even getting their news from the newspaper anymore?
No, I think they really still do care. Influencing the media, I would argue, is still an extremely important tactic, because whether you go to social media or TikTok or whatever, it doesn't matter. A lot of that originates with media reports. Very few people are directly following the Fraser Institute on social media, I would argue. And yet the Fraser Institute, in their annual report, they boast about how many media mentions they get every year. It's extremely important to them. And I know from supervising reporters myself that, you know, it's easy to harvest a quote from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation on any story that deals with government spending. Oh, my God, I need a reaction. I need a quote really fast. They're available.
I've done that. I've gone running to Canadian Taxpayers Federation because I need a quote and I need somebody who's following this. I've totally done that.
That's it, because they know how the game is played. A lot of these think tanks and organizations, they sound very authoritative. The MacDonald Laurier Institute, the Fraser Institute. Wow, it's named after a river in BC. Like, I've seen this with my own eyes. Young reporters will come back and there's a quote. I think some of them think this is like a university department and they don't dig into what is the ideology here. I don't think, never mind the public, actually don't think some journalists are fully cognizant of what's going on in some of these cases.
I think that you make an interesting point. We still matter, but I think it's a different kind of relevance than we used to have. It's not necessarily that you need to get your message out on the news because that's where the audience is. I think that the role has shifted where the value of getting news coverage as much as you can, beyond just being able to show, here's what I did and put it in your annual report, but to the point of actually shifting public opinion, it's still an important, like, vector. It's not the biggest disseminator of information. You know, it's still significant, but it's more about that so much other media builds on the record created by established legacy media. So much that you see on TikTok, so many aggregators, so many commentators, so much analysis. A Wikipedia article, well, you need to refer back to a news article. When Canada Land was the target of a very well-financed PR campaign to try to discredit our journalism, it was very interesting to me that among the many techniques and strategies used against us, one I think of the most successful ones was they were able to get an editorial placed in the Toronto Star, which was carefully written to read like a news story. The one that I have in mind was in their opinion section as an editorial, but unless you looked at that little designation, it read as a news story that it exonerated the organization that we'd been reporting on. That becomes sort of like one ingredient in a case that is being built, where if they can cite, here's all of these different news organizations agreeing on a narrative, regardless of whether or not people read these articles, it starts to build a counter-narrative, another consensus, and it becomes itself it's almost a circular thing. Then the originator organization can refer to all of these news stories that they planted and say, see, this has been confirmed and affirmed by all these different organizations. We still matter in that sense, though the degree to which media, which is so under fire and reporters are being so derided, and the concept that, you know, like simultaneously is this idea that we're all a bunch of liars and it's all fake news. And that brings me to something that you talk about as well, which is the government's decision to fund the news in Canada. How do you see that fitting in to this kind of like endless war between the PR industry and journalism?
It's kind of a bad situation for journalism these days in terms of all the money that's been bled out of the industry. Two of my suggestions for how to improve the situation, one of them is to help and really support all the different startup news organizations that have sprung up over the last few years. Some of them are doing fantastic work. They're covering topics that legacy mainstream media have stopped covering or can't cover properly. If Canadians think it's productive for government to be funding healthcare and social services and a whole bunch of other positive things for society, I think funding of journalism is also a positive thing for society, and it has to be done in a way that doesn't compromise the integrity of the journalism. And I think that's the tricky part. I worked for the CBC for many years, which is about 70% funded by government. Mm-hmm. I never felt, and I was a senior person in the CBC, I was a manager, I was a managing editor, I was a director. I never felt that government of the day was compromising the integrity of the organization. So I believe it can be done.
I worked at the CBC for a lot smaller point of time than you, Cecil. I never felt direct government pressure to influence any story, but I absolutely worked with colleagues who said things out loud because they're smart people who follow politics, who knew that their jobs were safer with one government than the other. You know, we knew that, and the public knows that we know that. And right now we have one federal party that's threatening to defund the CBC. All of that was a preamble to a very different criticism or perspective on government funding that I want to put to you from this lens of PR. I don't think that the government thinks and their intent is, oh, if we fund newspapers and news journalists, then we can control them and we can censor them. I actually don't think that that's possible or the intent at all. I do think that the government is very concerned about the destruction of the legacy Canadian news media and the rise of chaos in the information space. I do think that they have a daily need to get their message out there through their toolbox of PR tactics. That is a much harder thing to do in a fragmented media space that consists of wonderful independent journalism like Canada Land and agenda-driven, angry, quasi, whatever you want to call the rebel, and 100 other players or 1,000 other players. Is this chaotic, dispersed, fragmented new media space going to show up to your government press event? Are they going to diligently cover the budget announcement? If you call them up and try to feed them a little bit of advanced knowledge, do they give a damn? We march to a different drum, that we don't have to feed the goat in the same way. We don't have the same way of doing media. My belief as to why this is a priority for government is to maintain some kind of reliable, dependable, predictable channel for government messaging.
That's interesting, and I'm not disagreeing with you, actually. I actually think that's somewhere in their mind. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier. The media is still needed. The media is still needed by the shapers of public opinion to get their messages out. And I think that just reinforces that point even more. Like in my chapter on the police, I do mention that some police departments, Toronto and Winnipeg and others, have taken to creating their own channels of communication outside of conventional ones.
Yeah, you mentioned their podcast. We reported on that, like cop casting. They actually are just like, oh, if people want to hear crime stories, we got a bunch.
Exactly.
But it's not just the police. Politicians are doing it too.
They are.
Yeah, they're just writing us out of the pipeline entirely, which makes it a lot easier if they could actually get people to just, suck directly from their pipe, you know?
They're trying to. Look, there was an incident in Winnipeg last month. A 37-year-old Indigenous man was wandering in and out of traffic, banging on people's cars. Police were called. It was a wellness check. They were placing him into custody, and he died, okay? And that was the press release that the police put out, which everyone covered. You know, some person unfortunately died in the course of police trying to resolve this situation. Well, the next day, the CBC talked to an eyewitness and used the video that they shot of this fellow lying on the ground being pummeled by two police officers, kneed and slugged repeatedly, okay? The chief of police of Winnipeg, Danny Smythe, took to his own Substack page to criticize the media for daring to talk to eyewitnesses to this event because he said those people are not use of force experts and that it's the police narrative that should be followed here. And he was very clear and he was very transparent that the only narrative that should be followed here is the police narrative. So they use every means at their disposal in terms of influencing conventional media and now trying to create some of their own channels.
You know, there are a lot of former journalists working in PR. There are some former PR people working in journalism. There's nothing inherently wrong with wanting to get your story out for the person who's paying you. Right? And I think the vast majority of people working in PR would argue like, look, we're tired of this. What we do is benign. Every organization has some aspect of it that faces the public. Some are directly involved every day and some, you know, only at crisis times. And, you know, we focus on the worst of it, like the real manipulators, the crisis comms people, the people who are really trying to lie to the public. But day in and day out, like, I've actually seen information come out that, like, I'm glad I have.
And yeah, you think.
Well, as they go directly to the public, some of them are doing a decent job, and even some with agendas. Like there's a whole new category where the new jobs in news. Some of them are coming from, you know, we have Press Progress, which is funded out of the Broadbent Institute, which is an NDP-affiliated think tank that has its own news organ. Luc Lebrun, the editor of Press Progress, and all the good journalists who work for him will be very upset to hear themselves described in this way because I actually think they wake up every day and they do journalism, and they've actually broken some really good stories. But I've never read a story from Press Progress that would embarrass or contradict the agenda of the NDP. And maybe they can correct me on that, but, you know, they're looking for news stories that are true, verifiable news stories that benefit the political party or the ideology or the general point of view of the political party. You know, so that's a certain way of kind of putting some distance between, but we know why it's there. I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that. I think that one solution to all of this is like let 1,000 or 100,000 flowers bloom. Like if
have
you
more partisan media?
Well, that's where media started. I mean, people look at this one era where we had these central newspapers that were sort of the independent as like, well, that's what media is all about. That was very briefly what media tried to show itself to be about. And even then it was, you know, there was a fair amount of partisan influence. The beginning of media was pamphleteering and it's chaotic, it's scary, but when you have a multiplicity of interests using the truth to get their points across, and then if somebody goes too far, they get pushed by the other.